Yeah, here we are. Rock to Recovery Radio, back again. I am your host, Wes Gear, and this is KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM, human-crafted radio. This show is also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. They have a number of recovery programs, addiction, mental health for professionals, all sorts of people. If you're looking for a good program, they are definitely quality people doing really quality work. So I always intro the show with, why are we here? You know, I'm a sober guy, and I didn't die somehow, which is a miracle in and of itself. And somehow this radio show found its way to me. I live in Laguna. The station's in Laguna. They offered me a radio show. I was like, that sounds good. Let's do this. I'm passionate about carrying this message. So, you know, I think by now we've all lost people to mental health or suicide. Maybe they're a wounded vet or addiction. How many people do we know that have died from addiction? People we love, people close to us, people we knew, maybe celebrities that inspired us. We've all been touched by it in some form or fashion. But times are changing, and we're beyond that time where nobody spoke about it. Now we're out in the open and we talk about it, a lot of us, openly. And in so doing, we can bring information and strength and hope and inspiration to others that might be searching for answers, others that are struggling, others that just need support in their day-to-day sobriety, right? For most of us that are in recovery, we do this thing called recovery, and we use these tools of recovery every day. So that's what Rock to Recovery is designed to do. Offer a forum for which we can discuss and share stories. And what's cool is we have been blessed and been interviewing some incredible humans, rock stars, celebrities, wounded warriors, athletes, pro surfers, moms, just regular people, you know, but all exceptional earthlings that have battled these demons, their version of the demons, overcome them, and not just limped out of the fight like, okay, you know, I'm still here, but they get into what I like to call the vortex of radness, meaning what most of us find is you're in that spot like, I can't imagine life ever being good again. I feel so lost and alone, and I can't imagine not drinking or using or whatever it is. We can't imagine anything being better or different. And not only does it change, but it gets really amazing. And you hear these people's stories like we've had, life I've been exposed to in real life and on the show, and it's just incredible the transformations that take place. So today, I'm very excited to introduce our guest for today. I think I said that twice. So she is a writer, and she's also, what I thought was interesting as I was doing a little bit of research here, a sex therapist, and she likes to keep it weird in her own her own words. And I don't know if those two things were meant to be attached to each other, but having said that, she was also married to Joe Walsh, the world famous guitar player of the Eagles, and he also had solo records. So you can imagine that all might kind of roll together in certain tangent ways, but we'll find out. But she's in recovery herself, battled alcohol and drug addiction. Please welcome to the show, Kristen Casey. Ah, yeah. Oh,
hi.
Kristen. I always feel like there needs to be a big round of applause there. So I just.
I like that. I think everyone should do that when they introduce me from now on.
Yeah.
Let's make that a trend.
Oh, Kristen, we love you. We love you. Oh my God, I read your book. It changed my life. Ah. Yeah. We've got to have some fun with it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a retired stripper, so with 14 years of being on stage and getting way more than my fair share of attention and appreciation and praise, I would say it would be a really bad habit for me to get into needing that from everyone the rest of my life. I've had my share. I need to move on.
They say in recovery, your ego is not your amigo, right? We want top praise all the time. And for us in recovery, it's like if you pay your rent on time, you're like, look, I paid my rent. It's like, dude, that's kind of normal. you know, you want a parade, you paid your rent. Wow. So, yeah, we love to get into that praise and ego. And then we have that inferiority complex, a lot of us do, right? We think we're all that, we're grandiose, and then we're insecure at the same time. How do we do that?
Yeah, it's really it's a miracle of addiction, I would say. And it's minute to minute too. I don't care how great you think I am, or you thought I was 5 minutes ago. I need you to tell me again. I need it, because I don't know how to feel about myself 5 minutes from now or another 5 minutes from now. You know what I mean?
That's a great statement. Yeah, and I think that ties into kind of that thing where, you know, excuse me, where, hey, if I just get the job, or if I get the boy, or if I get the girl, or if I get this new dress or this new shirt, or we're chasing those things outside of ourselves to make us feel good. Hey, if you just acknowledge me and praise me, but it doesn't last, does it?
No, everything that comes from an outward source is, you know, bound to disappoint you or not be there someday. I mean, in a perfect world, we would all have two very attentive, attuned, loving parents that had all the time in the world and all the energy in the world and all the parenting skills in the world, and there would be nothing that would ever go wrong or awry or make us feel anxious or abandoned or insecure, and we don't live in that world. So, I mean, that's the only place that I think that you should be guaranteed that you're going to get that validation and that self-esteem and that knowledge that you're lovable just for who you are. But the problem is that, you know, your parents and your teachers and everyone in the world are, they're human, and they probably didn't get it either.
Right.
So then we just, you know, we grow up looking for it in everything and everyone we can.
Yeah. So, you know, I love that. And I think we talk about it from time to time, which is, you know, we aren't born with a handbook on how to love, how to be a mom or a dad. We learn as we go. We learn from examples. A lot of the examples are wrong, and we don't know they're wrong because they're the only thing we ever knew. So for sure. And then on top of that, you could argue, you know, and you hear people talk about it often. Hey, I came from a perfect home. My family was great. I mean, what is perfect, of course, but, you know, a loving home and supportive. My mom and dad were there. It was great. And still I turned into a crackhead. So, we're emotional beings, we're volatile, who knows about, you know, dispositions we're born with and hereditary ailments. There's no rules in this game, is there?
There are a lot of factors, for sure, and it's true. I mean, look at any one family that had more than one kid. I mean, most parents, I think that the studies show that parents don't generally treat every child identical, but the disparity in how one will grow up versus another, I mean, you see that all the time. There's so many factors. And temperament is a thing. I know that I even asked my dad this not long ago, what I was like when I was born. Because I was, you know, ever since I got sober, very curious about nature versus nurture and how much of my, you know, I had very severe depression for most of my life. And I think anyone who has that, and that includes a lot, you know, a huge percentage of addicts and alcoholics, you wonder where that comes from, you know, and you want to kind of figure it out because you feel like it'll help you, and it does. I think a certain amount of self-awareness will help you at least find the types of therapy or relationships or interactions and behaviors and communities that are going to benefit you. If you understand what the problem is, you're much more likely to find a solution. So along that search, I asked my dad, what was I like when I was first born? Like, was I different from my older two siblings and my younger ones? And he just, without missing a beat, he says, you came out screaming and you haven't stopped since. My older siblings, both of them were actually, really mellow kids. My older brother was really, sort of a serious, quiet boy. And then my older sister was just the sweetest, cutest, dimpled, compared to me, anyway. Of course, anyone was compared to me. And I was like the loud, I wanted attention and I wanted it now. And when you have three kids at such a young age, you know, my mom had the first three or four, like one right after the other. There's only so much attention to go around. So if you have a temperament, you can be born sort of prone to anxiety. And then if you don't get the attention you need, and then you get bullied in school, or, I mean, it can happen.
There's a lot of ways it can happen. Yeah,
absolutely.
And that's why I think another reason that it's very important that we talk about this stuff and see that, you know, a lot of the elements are exactly the same when we talk about addiction. There's a lot of commonalities in there, and there's a lot of commonalities in the approach to recovery. At the same time, it's kind of a mystery how it starts can start so differently. There's not just one story that everybody follows. So I love that you're into your childhood. And, you know, one of my favorite girlfriends that I was so in love with ever was a full nude dancer. She was the sweetest, most devoted, amazing girl. So I have a soft spot in my heart for girls who do that. And I say that with all sincerity, not with a rock and roll smirk. You know, because we're all just humans, fine in our own way. So you come out and your parent, and I'm glad that you led into the childhood, because I like talking about that, especially when it seems to be so relevant. So you come out and your parents even picked up on, like, hey, you're a little more, dare I say, restless, irritable, and discontent at an early age. What transpired from, you know, toddler to teenager that was noteworthy?
You know, I actually have given that a lot of thought. Yeah, and the first thing I want to say is that my parents are great people, and everyone who meets them will tell you that. And they were, in some ways, the best parents you could ask for.
Mm-hmm.
And then in other ways, you know, they parented the way they were parented. I was raised in a Catholic, my family was Catholic. Both my parents were Catholic, and they had four kids right away, and then a fifth that came later. And my mom was a nurse, and my dad was a milkman for a while, and then he got into real estate investing. And so every 5 years growing up, we moved up a little bit into a slightly bigger house, slightly better neighborhood. And so we did that 3 or 4 times by the time I was 15. You know, I went to a Catholic school. There was no abuse. There was no violence in my family. There was no addiction. My parents barely drank at all.
But nobody was a raging alcoholic.
No.
Yeah.
No. There was, you know, depression runs in families. And so on one side of my family, there is a history of what and nobody really thought about it much, because I think it was kind of hidden. But there's some suicide, there's some depression, there's some what they now believe is alcoholism. They're like, oh yeah, remember that one great uncle so and so who used to go in the barn with a bottle of whiskey? You know, like, nobody really talked about it. You didn't talk about your feelings, and you didn't talk about what you did to manage your feelings. You know,
right.
you did the work.
Very different now.
Yeah. So growing up, I had two parents who were there. But they both worked really hard. They worked long hours. And my first recollections were of desperately wanting more attention and to feel loved from my mother. My dad made me feel really loved. He was really open. He was just, that's his nature. You know, both my parents loved me, but my dad was very affectionate, and he showed it more. And my mom was, you know, she had four young kids, and she had a high-stress job, and she was very young. And she was a perfectionist, and she... You know, her mother was very sort of a, God-lover. Grandma was a bit of a taskmaster, and I think my mom just felt on a daily basis that she had to really do everything perfectly, and that's a recipe for disaster when you have four kids at 25.
That's just not going to happen, is it?
Yeah.
So you felt kind of like craving mom's attention or love or adoration a little bit more than you were getting?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And were you aware of that at that young age?
Oh, yeah. I remember having thoughts, what's wrong with me? Why won't she love me?
Mm.
Because when you're 3 or 4 or 5 and you're not getting, you don't feel loved, the only thing you can assume is that it's your fault. There's something wrong with you, because what else could it be? Your parents are gods. Your parents are your gods. They're, you know, so if you're not getting the love that you need, it must be because you're not lovable. And so, yeah, I remember having those feelings at, you know, very, very early ages.
And you're also not going to think, maybe I'm tripping. Maybe they do love me and I'm just kind of being a weirdo. You know what I mean? Because we can all be hyper emotional or have a reaction that really isn't based in truth. You know, when you're that young, you're just not going to be that aware. Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
And I, you know, I've known for a long time, I'm sort of a glass half empty person. But I believe that that can be changed. If I can change from the crackhead that I was, who wanted to kill herself, who thought she was worthless, to the productive person who gets out of bed with excitement every day and has quality friendships and relationships and has a reason to be here in this world and a purpose, you know, I've been sober for 21 years and it just keeps on giving. I think if you inventory all of your feelings, but your resentments and your fears and all of that type of stuff, then you're going to understand where they're coming from and how you can redirect them. And so frequently I find myself these days just sitting and closing my eyes and letting myself really absorb and sit with something amazing that just happened and feel grateful, just feel awash in gratitude. And as soon as I do that, then the enthusiasm and the joy and the feelings that I didn't get to feel when I was younger, because I was feeling so much anguish and pain and insecurity and sort of this, like I wasn't lovable, which is such a painful feeling. And my mother, God love her, she was, you know, could be very critical, cause she was a perfectionist and, you know, kids aren't perfect. So, I would react to that by sort of dissociating. And when you dissociate from your painful feelings of shame for not being good enough or fear that you might, you know, be punished or whatever, you also dissociate from your ability to feel your positive feeling, your joy and love and excitement. And so when I started drinking at 15, my father had gone bankrupt, and it happened very suddenly, and it changed everything about our lives.
So you're a upper middle class home, doing pretty well, and then boom.
Yeah, we had just gotten there. We'd just gotten the house with a pool.
And so what happened to Dad?
Oh, you know, it was just a business thing that sort of ended up blowing up. And so he moved the family to Texas from San Diego. And so I lost, you know, everything that I...
Where were you before that?
San Diego.
You're in San Diego. And so you go to Amarillo, Texas. Well, my parents divorced too. And I never like to put blame or make my mom
feel bad, but it's
tough for a kid to handle that, especially when you have to move and school's hard and getting reacclimated and making new friends. And I think like what you're talking about is, my friend calls it the default settings. I think the default settings of an alcoholic or an addict tend to be a little darker, right? You were talking a lot about, instead of like going, wow, I got a compliment today, we'll go, oh, thanks, I look pretty cool, right on. And then we'll think of all the bad stuff that we don't like or all the stress in our life. I totally get that. So if you have those default settings and you move, because again, other people may move and be in that similar situation and deal with it okay. But when you have this perfect storm brewing for people like you and I get it. It gets really hard. So you're 15, and then did you start getting loaded at that time?
Yeah. You know, and it's really funny what you say, too, because I had two role models. My parents didn't actually get divorced. I had two role models, and I just didn't go that route, I guess. I don't know. I think some of that, again, is ingrained. But I had started drinking. I mean, I'd had my first drink, like, maybe a year or two earlier, like a year and a half earlier.
In San Diego.
I was 14, yeah. And I tell you, when I drank it, it was a shot of tequila. This guy was babysitting for. He and his wife come home from dinner. They clearly had a fight because she just kind of storms into the baby's room and shuts the door, and he brings me in the kitchen and pours me a shot of tequila. And he was very cute, and I was very curious, and so I drank that tequila, and by the time it hit my belly, I mean, the skies parted, and I just thought, I am pretty, and I am confident, and I'm smart, and I'm witty, and I'm attractive, and I'm going to have this really fascinating conversation with this very handsome doctor.
I was the same way.
As soon as I had a drink, I understood.
It was very confusing.
This is what, yeah. So yeah. I drank a little here and there. I mean, I loved school. I was good at school, and I didn't have access to booze. But when I would babysit, I would sneak a little Tupperware or an old perfume bottle, and I'd get like 1 ounce out of somebody's, you know, liquor cabinet. I would sneak it, and then my girlfriends would find ways of getting some themselves. And then when we would meet at the dance, like once a month or whatever, we'd each pour whatever stash we'd brought into our Cokes. So I'd catch a buzz here and there. And
wasn't it cool being that young, where a little bit just got you all buzzed? I remember half of Mickey's Big Mouth got me so loaded.
Yeah.
I loved it. It doesn't last very long.
Yeah. And what's funny is by the time the summer of 83, I was 15. That's the summer we moved. I stayed behind for a couple of months with friends of the family, and there was a girl my age there, and so she and I went out one night. We were both 15, I guess, and she had a couple of friends, and we played quarters. So I'm with teenagers, not at a dance with one little aunt, but I'm in a room with beer and I forget what else, but there were four teenagers and a stash of booze, so I could have more than that one gulp for the first time. And I got drunk. I got wasted. And I remember that night. I remember we played quarters, and then everyone wanted to walk to the park, but I had to drink the rest of everything that was out first. Even though I was drunk, I was making an ass out of myself. And nobody else was, and I could see this, and I liked this boy, and I could see that he was starting to not like me, but I couldn't not drink more. And I thought to myself, that's so weird. I can't not do this. I'm embarrassing myself, and I know it, and I can't not do this. And they seem fine. I'm reacting differently, and I didn't understand that at all. So a couple months later, I get to Texas, and I make friends right away with this other edgy kid who was turned out to be my best friend for the next 10 years. And every weekend, really for the next, all through high school, junior and senior year, every weekend I binge drank. And I was a blackout drinker. Every Friday, Saturday, all through my, from I turned 16. This started right before I turned 16. And it went on. I left home at 17, and I was drinking, getting wasted almost every weekend until I got out of high school.
That's incredible. That's pretty young. I definitely drank. I definitely got drunk in high school a lot and sought it out. But, yeah, it sounds like this really isn't relevant in the big scheme of things. I just think it's interesting how quickly you got into it. They do talk about how women can go through the phases of addiction and alcoholism more quick. There's a lot of data that they go through it oftentimes more quickly than men. So when did it start? You're drinking, you're sneaking around. When did it start getting bad, and when did you get into being a stripper? I think that's what you called it, yeah?
Yeah. Well, I moved to Austin for college when I was 17, and that would have been 85. I didn't realize again until many years later, looking back on that period. My parents worked so hard through the hardest period of their life, and they imparted in me the strongest work ethic I think they could have, which is probably the most important thing a parent can give a child. Like, they set me up to survive. It is a parent's job to protect a child, but, you know,
you can't blame them for it.
No, you can't. My parents they couldn't stop the bankruptcy. They couldn't stop bullying. They couldn't stop, you know, any of that. And so you make choices in life. And by the time I was 16 and 17, I was making, you know, very clear choices. I was not a stupid person.
So at 18, you're still binging, and now you're stripping.
Well, I went to UT. You know, I went to Austin to go to UT, and I was so insecure and unsure of myself that
Were you still punk rock girl at this time?
Yeah.
Okay. So punk rock binge, like the drink. You said you're angry.
Drinking, but meth. I mean, the punk scene in Austin was amazing. Yeah.
So listen, let's throw in our song now. And the first song you picked, I think, is it Life in the Fast Lane?
Yeah. I met Joe when I was 20, but I had heard that song, you know,
years
honestly,
before.
Anyone who had a radio heard that song for yeah. years in the 70s and 80s. So
you met Joe when you were 20?
I met him when I was 20, yeah. I got to Austin, I did a bunch of speed, then I quit, then I started stripping, and then 2 years later I met Joe.
Okay, gotcha. I thought you were going to be tweaking and stripping, which seems like
it's funny. I did it backwards. I quit meth by starting to strip. It was the most bizarre backwards thing ever. But
well, good
for
you.
That's what I did.
But this is Wes Geer. I'm your host. We're on Rock to Recovery Radio. We're here with Kristen Casey, Joe Walsh of the Eagles, ex-wife and writer. She has a great book out. She's telling her story now, where she's struggled as a kid, and now she's gotten into meth. And well, actually, she just quit meth, and she's been stripping. So it's very apropos. We throw in Life in the Fast Lane by the Eagles. We'll be right back. I love that guitar riff. That was one of the first ones I learned. It's just such a cool guitar riff. And by the way, I haven't told you this, but I love Joel Walsh's playing. It's so slinky, and that vibrato he has is incredible. But I got to tell people who we are. This is Wes Geer. This is Rock to Recovery Radio. We're on KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM, Human Crafted Radio, also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. They have a variety of treatment programs. They do great work. I suggest if you're searching for help or need to get somebody into treatment, check out New Vista Behavioral Health. We are back online with Kristen Casey. She's telling her story of being an angry punk rock kid despite her parents working so hard, coming out the womb feeling a little restless, irritable, discontent, and being a binge drinker and moving from San Diego to Austin. Had some problems with meth too. Quit the meth, and then you're stripping. So you said you were 18. You had heard Life in the Fast Lane a bunch of times, but you hadn't met Joe. You met him when you were 20. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I'd been dancing for about 2.5 years, I guess, and
so he didn't meet you in the titty bar?
No, actually, that was, you know.
Is that inappropriate? I call it the titty bar. I'm sorry.
No, maybe that's what we called them back then.
That's actually what we called them. So it's stuck. And maybe it's not PC, but that's stuck in my mind. So
yeah.
Maybe I have to give it. It just came out like it was automatic.
It was
the
so
gentleman's
funny.
Club.
I had a little flashback, like a little visceral sort of flashback.
Yeah.
Because you never hear that term anymore. But that was absolutely what
I just
what
dated
we used
myself.
To say.
Okay,
yeah,
so
yeah.
Were you stripping? Were you dancing?
Yeah. So I was working at a club in Austin called Sugars, and I my drinking. Like,
what was your dancer name?
Casey. Or no, I actually went by Christy then, and then
Christy,
when I started.
It wasn't
up
like
again
Anastasia or Diamond.
You know, it's so funny. There was a girl in the punk scene that I always thought was just so pretty and feminine, and her name was Sita. My first night at the club, the manager was like, "All right, fill out this form, and then I'm going to put you on stage." And I was like so panicked and nervous. I mean, I just could barely breathe. And so there's a line on there for a dance name. And I was like, I wonder if that's a stage name. But I didn't know. So I said, what does this mean? What is this?
Mm.
Yeah, I put my name, but what is this dance name? And he goes, you know, like a stage name. And he's like, hurry up, hurry up. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll go by that name. And I literally had 1 minute to think about it. And I just thought,
second girl that told me this. We had somebody else on the show who was a dancer who said the same thing. Like, I just had to come up with something fast. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot of pressure. I mean, if you think about it, one of the funnest things about stripping is you get to put on, you get to come up with a whole new identity if you want.
Yep.
And you can change it every time you change clubs. But this was what was weird for me, and this actually was a thread throughout my whole life. At that point in my life, I just wanted to be me. You know, I wanted to...
Interesting.
I just wanted... The punk rock thing, you know, I wasn't a tough chick, but I always tried to act tough because I thought it would protect me from getting hurt. So I hit the scene and I hung out with the speed punks and I got my butt kicked. You know, I mean, I got robbed a couple of times. I got abducted. I was beaten. I was threatened with death by a group of people. I had to escape to maybe save my life. I don't know if they were going to kill me, but they said they were going to. And so it was a really hairy situation. And I quit speed and continued using, acid and mushrooms or whatever. But and then I started stripping, and so I could drink as much as I wanted, even though I wasn't of legal age. My boss just let me. What I wanted to do was get back in school, because I dropped out of UT my second semester, and I just wanted to go back to school. I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to become an adult, you know. And so in my panic, I thought, there was a voice in my head saying, just be yourself. It's time for you to just, make your, own your space or what. I don't know what I was thinking.
And
but
this
it was
is happening
this,
while you're
yeah,
becoming
sitting,
a stripper.
Sitting in the manager's office. So I just wrote my real name, Christy.
That's interesting.
And that's what I went by for 10 years. I danced there for 5 years, but in that period I met Joe and then eventually moved in with him. And then after we broke up, I went back to stripping. So anyway, I went by Christy, and I had a really good friend there after a couple of years named Vicky. And she had met Joe and his bass player in 87, I guess. I think they had been through town playing a gig. She met him at a record store. And so she'd been dating his bass player, Rick Rosas, and flying around the country on tour with them and sometimes... and I wasn't really paying. I knew she was dating some musician, but I was still kind of into new wave and the punk stuff, and I liked some classic rock, but I didn't know the names of any bands. You know, I was even at 20, my DJ
didn't really
register
with you.
No, I mean, I knew who the Eagles were, but I didn't, the name Joe Walsh didn't mean anything to me.
Sure.
I knew who the, like, Doobie Brothers were, and I knew who, you know, Aerosmith was or whatever. I knew who Stevie Ray Vaughan was, but I didn't know the name Joe Walsh. So one night she says, hey, the guy I'm dating is in town, and his best friend, the singer and guitar player, is recently become single. Give me a ride after work to the hotel. And she just asked me for a ride at first, and then I'm like, yeah, sure. So we, on the way there at like 2:30 in the morning, she's like, you got to come up and meet this guy Joe, I think you'll really like him, blah blah blah. And I was like, I think she's fixing me up. And I, you know, I was tired, but I thought, I'm gonna be polite. So she liked kind of, you know, those long-haired Joe Perry type rockers, and I wasn't really sure who she was trying to fix me up with, but I had a feeling I was going to be like, you know, faking a yawn and leaving 15 minutes later. So I go upstairs with her, and she introduced me to Rick and Joe, and I just couldn't take my eyes off him. I just thought, there's something really interesting about this guy. He's really cute and definitely different, and I'm definitely going to stay for a while.
What was the scene? Was there a little hotel party going on?
It was the four of us.
Okay.
We were at the Radisson. They had a suite at the Radisson. And it's kind of funny because it's a couple of rockers, a couple of strippers, 3 a.m. in a hotel room, and all we did was just talk and hang out. And then Joe was like drawing double horns on the TV screen on Bernard Shaw's face from CNN, and like he was trying to do the moonwalk for me. And it was just so sweet and goofy, and like he was silly, and he kept telling jokes that were only half funny, but his like animated delivery was hysterical. And I, like 20 minutes into this, I realized I'm in love with the guy. Like I heard a voice
really?
In my head. Like I heard a voice in my head, and it said, "This is the man you're meant to marry."
Wow.
Yeah. So I stayed the night, went to the show the next day. Still didn't know who.
What happened
was.
The first night?
Did you guys get down? You know, that's the whole first chapter of the book, and I will tell you, it was not what I expected. It was a little frustrating. It was very interesting, and in the end, I didn't care. I loved the guy, and I just knew we were meant to be together. And,
so you have love at first sight, and you're not on meth or piles of cocaine.
Right. I wasn't even that
mellow.
Wasted. Yeah,
you weren't even that wasted. So you fell in love with him, and for those listening in, we're talking to Kristen Casey, ex-wife, right? Of
actually fiance.
Sorry,
we never did get married. Yeah, we were engaged for about a year.
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's fine.
The Eagles.
Everyone does it.
The Eagles guitar player and singer Joe Walsh. So you stay the night and you didn't. Okay, so if you want to know what happens in detail, check out our book Rock Monster: My Life with Joe Walsh by Kristen Casey. So we'll skip over that part. Maybe help you sell a few more books. I know I'm intrigued.
Well, I'll tell you a little. I'll give you a hint. I mean, I will say this. I was a very sexual person, and I was not ashamed of that. I really owned my sexuality from a young age. I mean, I was not totally uninhibited.
Most strippers are sexual.
Yeah, I mean, I did that. My Catholic upbringing kind of did a number on me, but I really felt like my sexuality was something that belonged to me, and I wasn't going to let anyone, you know, brainwash it out of me or shame me for it. And I loved. One of the reasons I loved being a stripper was because, you know, right or wrong, and there are some definite, you know, dysfunctional things going on in there, it also is one of the only places, especially then in the 80s, when, you know, sexuality was celebrated and not shamed. And you could just,
I get it. So tell, we want to know, did Joe give it up or not? I think that's what we're getting.
No, I jumped him. I tried everything I could. Every maneuver in my wheelhouse, and I just could not.
See, there you have it at home, ladies and gentlemen. All us band guys are not the same. Joe Walsh of the Eagles has this beautiful strawberry blonde, it looks like, stripper in the room. She wants to get down. Joe doesn't give it up, and they fall madly in love. I think that needs to go down in the annals of rock and roll. We get a bad rap. I mean, it's all true. It's a lot of it's true, but it's not all true. Okay, so, you know, we don't have a ton of time left, but I want to – so you guys get together, and was it good for a while? Because the book is Rock Monster. That sounds like Joe's not going to be too happy about that title, if you know what I mean.
Well, you know, the thing with the title, I never intended to use it. It was my working title, and it's a play on words. It doesn't really mean what it seems to mean. It's not, first of all, it doesn't even, it's not about Joe, it's really about me. The term monster gotcha. Was our pet name for each other. And it was like party monster. Like if we stayed up for 2 or 3 days and we were like looking around at the totally trashed room, we might say, wow, we really monstered, didn't we? Or if he saw me do 4 hog rails in a row, he'd be like, God, you're such a monster.
Hog rails. Like, I'm guessing that's a giant lines of cocaine.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, all right.
Yeah. So
partiers make up their own terms. They do.
Yeah.
But to the lay people, they don't always know that.
Yeah, hog girls came from some guy they knew, some crazy. I didn't know him, but I didn't know what it meant when I met him either. So,
so it's good,
you know,
for
it was
a while.
Pet name. It was good for a while. Like we, you know, that he was in town. We met the next day. I went to his concert. I discovered who he was, and I was like, oh my God, this guy's huge. I know these songs. I'm standing there in the audience, going, I know these songs. Oh my God, he's huge. He's never going to call me, but he did, and he felt something too, and so. Over the course of the summer, we kind of slowly got together, and then, within a few months, I guess I was his girlfriend. And I wasn't using coke. I didn't want to go back down that meth path. But after another few months, you know, he kept different hours. He'd come see me, or I'd go to L.A. and see him, or on the road, and he and Rick would stay up till, you know, sunrise, and I'd get there, and I'd be crashed out. So after a few months of dating, I was like, well, give me a little bump so I can stay up with you guys. I want to, you know, I'm only
here
for the week.
So they were tweaking?
Or whatever. They were doing coke. It was always coke,
okay.
Never anything else.
Gotcha.
Well, the problem was, this went on for 2.5 years, and then eventually I was like, look, I got to go back. I dropped out of school like 2 more times because we kept traveling. Every time I'd register for classes, I'd get halfway through a semester, and we'd go to Japan, or we'd go, you know, somewhere else, and so I kept dropping out of college. I was like, look, I love you, but I either have to apply myself to college or maybe move to LA with you. And so he's like, yep, I'm going to buy you a house. So grab the cat and come on out. And that's what happened. So I moved to LA, and then I didn't have to work anymore. And I was around the cocaine all the time. And I mean, by the end of that year, which was 91, I was using more coke. I was 23, 24, maybe 91. I turned, that fall, I turned 24. I was using more coke than Joe, who was 44, and he'd been using for, like, you know, 25 years. And then
well,
I blew
I
out my septum.
I hope you're using more than him. He's getting old. You could do a lot more coke
yeah.
when you're younger.
Yeah. Well, I blew out my septum, right? So I put a big hole in it, and then I started smoking crack because I would just cook it down myself because I thought I would rationalize it, again with the rationalization, right? Like I could have said, oh, maybe I should stop doing this, or, you know, but I didn't. I thought, oh, I'll just find a more dangerous way to, you know, I mean,
it's a progressive disease. That's what we find. And we don't realize it, I don't think, fully, maybe a little bit. I wasn't sitting there going, oh, I'm getting worse and worse and worse. But it's happening. And and there's a saying in one of the pieces of literature. It says our alcoholic life seemed the only normal one. So if you back up, probably if you said to the young you, hey, you're going to smoke crack, you'd be like, heck no, I'll never do that. Then when you're smoking crack, you're like, what's the big deal? It's only crack, right?
Yeah.
A lot of us do that. And I noticed in reading some of the notes here, it says that that's when the marriage proposal came, two of them on crack.
Yeah.
Joe was cracked out. You guys are smoking crack. And he's like, baby, I love you. We got to do this for the rest of our lives.
He was not. No, he would never do it with me. He would never smoke crack. Yeah. He would just, I was.
He didn't care that you smoked it?
He didn't like it. At first, he never liked it. He never approved of it. But he sort of was, when he proposed, I had just started, he proposed in 92, and I started. So I'd been doing it less than a year, probably, and not all the time. But it was slowly getting out of hand. And so he, when he proposed, he did say later that night, this is contingent on you quitting crack. You have to stop smoking it, or I won't marry you. And I was like, dude, I'm stopping tomorrow, you know?
Yeah.
But then I everything went downhill from there, you know, because, like you say, it's a progressive disease. I couldn't put the pipe down, and that's when I realized how bad my problem was. Like, I knew, I kind of went back and forth. On any given day, I'd be like, I'm fine, you're making a big deal out of nothing, I want to stop, and I can't. And I eventually was having an affair with someone who started smoking crack with me, and he proposed as well. And I said yes. Yeah, I said yes to him, and then the next day I was like, wait, I'm actually engaged to someone, so let me get back to you.
Does Joe know? We want to know.
It's in the book. He was Sam Kinison's, one of his Sam Kinison's best friends. His name was Majid, and he...
Matches?
Magid, like magic, only with a D
Magid,
at the end.
His name
of
was
the dog.
Magid. Yeah, Magid. Okay, so you for a brief second you had two fiancés.
Yeah, for about 12 hours, 8 hours, something like that.
So, you know what? We're going to throw in this other song here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about how you hit bottom and what you're doing now that makes your life so amazing. You were talking about it earlier in the show. So, for the listeners at home, this is Kristen Casey, the former fiancé of Magid and Joe Walsh of the Eagles. And wow, we're at the story of the progression of being a punk rock stripper and having a crack problem, not being able to quit. We'll find out what happens when we're back. And what's the song we're about to play here?
Oh, I think this is Terry Reed, right? Bang Bang. Terry was a friend of ours, and he and I just adored him. He's an amazing talent, an incredible singer. If you've never heard him before, you will find out in just a moment, but this song, Bang Bang, is one of my favorites. And he was originally going to be the singer for Led Zeppelin, but he was only 16. Yeah, so
this is good trivia. I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah.
Terry Reed, Bang Bang. Okay, well, now I'm excited here. I wonder if I've heard it before. So this is Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Geer, KX93.5 FM. We're here with Kristen Casey, and this is Tori Reed, the almost was the singer of... Sorry, what?
Terry Reed.
Yeah. Sorry. The almost singer of Led Zeppelin doing Bang Bang. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. That is crazy. That is Terry Reid, and he was almost in Zeppelin. I gotta go look up the story. Anyhow, I'm your host, Wes Geer. This is Rock to Recovery Radio, KX93.5 FM, also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. They are sponsors of Rock to Recovery's event, and they have great treatment programs. So if you're looking for help or somebody you know somebody that is, check out New Vista Behavioral Health. We're here with Kristen Casey. She's a writer. She's a sex therapist. She likes to keep it weird. She was engaged to not only Joe Walsh, Eagles, world famous Eagles guitar player and singer, but also Sam Kinison's buddy, Majid, but she bailed on him. Anyhow, we're chronicling her story through addiction. It was drinking, it was cocaine, then it was crack. And now we're going to find out how she hit bottom. So, Kristen, thanks for being here with us. And tell us, what happened?
So, as you can imagine, crack smoking is not the best, healthiest thing for a long-term relationship. And so, we eventually really broke up over that. And that is where the title of the book comes from, by the way. Like, the rock monster was really about me.
Oh, I get it now.
I was a crack rock monster.
Crack rock monster. Oh,
yeah.
I totally get it. Okay, it makes sense now. Totally makes sense.
Anyway, yeah, I wasn't going to name it that, but my publisher loved it, and I was like, all right, unless you can think of a better one. And so I just said, didn't want anyone to think Joe was a monster. He's like, no, they're going to think he was a party monster. But as I'm finding out, every now and then somebody thinks the other. So I'm glad I cleared that up.
Yeah, I'm glad you cleared it up. But let's keep in mind, so this, we talk, you know, we can outline how the disease progresses and what it does. So you love Joe. You want to be with him. And he's like, babe, I don't care. You know, if you do some coke, but just stop smoking crack. And that ended up, you lost your relationship over that. That's a testament to the powerlessness.
Yeah. I mean, I was really delusional at that point. You know, crack, I've been using for 5 years straight. And then all the drinking too that came before it. And so, I made this decision. I don't need him. The love of my life. I'm going to go move to Vegas with this guy who doesn't even have a job and gets a little violent now and then. You know, so I moved to Vegas and very quickly realized I've made a horrible mistake. And I, 6 months later, I quit doing so much drugs, and I started stripping again. So I still had a very big drinking problem because that was really always my first love. I was more than anything, I was always an alcoholic. But I started a campaign to get Joe back, and eventually I did. And it was right before the Eagles got back together, and he got sober. So literally the day after we got back together, he ends up in rehab, and then the next number of weeks and months go by, and he just gets healthier and healthier, and I'm still drinking, and so you can guess, you know, where that ended up. A year later, we're like strangers. So we broke up again a second time, and that one devastated me because I had invested everything in his identity as a rock, my identity as a rock star's girlfriend. I didn't, you know, I'd thrown away college, I'd thrown away my health, I'd thrown away my friends. I lived in Vegas. I kicked that guy to the curb. God love him, he had his own problems. You know, I mean, he was a good man who was going through some stuff, too.
Did you go into a rehab?
I didn't. I should have, probably, because it was really touch and go. I was trying to drink myself to death for 2 years, so my health was so poor that when I got sober, it was because I was going through withdrawal. I mean, I was having delirium tremens, and I was...
And for people at home, a lot of them don't know, you can die from the two things is benzos and alcohol. You can die when you're detoxing. It's very important to do it medically.
Yeah,
but you didn't die.
I didn't die. I refused to. There was someone who tried to take me to the hospital. I refused because I wanted to die. But the thing is, I lay there in bed just in this state of limbo, this excruciating pain all day, not getting better, not getting worse. And I couldn't talk. I couldn't move. And all I could do was lay there and think. And I look back now and I think, you know, I've always believed that there's something, that whatever that higher power is, I don't like to get into that. It's my own personal beliefs. Everyone has their own. But I believed something was there.
And something more.
And I believe that I was being given that day, that moment, to make a decision. Which way do you want to go? Because this is the road you've been going down for 29 years at that point. You know, I was 29 years old. And something in me just snapped, and I just realized this is not how I meant to go. I have a purpose here. I had one. I probably blew it. You know, I just figured, you know, my higher power had given up on me. And again, that was a rationalization. I was rationalizing my suicide attempt and my active addictions. The truth was I wasn't trying hard enough, and I needed to give it my all. And I needed to find another purpose. Whatever the first one was, I was sure I had blown it, but I was just going to try. I was going to find someone to help me. If I live through the day, I told myself, I will find that girl at work who's always telling me she's saving me a seat at those meetings.
Oh.
And I'll do those stupid steps. I'll prove
so
it at work.
You had an Eskimo that you kind of tucked away like, yeah, maybe someday I'll need that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that tell us a lot of things, and hey, I'll take you to my friend Bob's house. You don't remember, but for some reason, it sounds like you remembered that gal who said, "I'll save you a seat." And so you reached out to her, and she took you to a meeting.
I mean, that is a testament to being of service. Like I should have been sober for 2 years, and every now and then she would just come up to me and talk to me a little about it, remind me she was saving me a seat. How's your life going? How bad are things? You know, like she would make me talk about how bad things were. So she actually was out of town. When I finally was able to get out of bed a couple days later, I called her. She was out of town, but I did go to the. She told me where to go, and there was a bunch of strangers in, you know, of all different sort of job descriptions and financial classes and I mean just a real eclectic group of people who for some reason were accepting me and wanting to. Embrace me and love me and help me, and I thought they were weird, and there was something, you know, untrustworthy about that, and but I had nowhere else to go. And
isn't that funny though?
Yeah.
We'll be drug addicts and we'll hang out with crackheads and we'll do all this stuff, and then if we go into like these recovery rooms of various treatment programs, we're like, these people are weird. It's like, dude, you're hanging out with a junkie drug dealer. Yeah, I get it. I feel like that's the disease trying to keep us away. So what was key for you? What was key for you in those early moments to really latch on and get recovery?
For me, the number one key was coping skills. I did not know how to identify all of my emotions. You know, I was in denial about a lot of things, so I didn't even really know how to recognize some of the thoughts I was having and the denial that I was in. I needed some really basic coping skills. I needed to learn how to accept life on life's terms. I needed to learn how to identify my resentments and my fears, and I needed to learn how to make restitution for my hurtful behavior, and I needed to learn how to be of service and how to, I needed a structured life. I didn't have any structure in my life, and I love structure. So I immediately from day one, I mean, I started making to-do lists
for the people who don't know at home, what you're explaining is a process that happens in the 12 steps.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that you got a sponsor and they took you through the 12 steps. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because the first month I just kept going back every other day just because they were the only people, you know, there was a part of me that wanted to believe them when they said, "We can help you. We love you. It's okay.
We usually won't believe that until we're desperate enough, right? Right?
Yeah.
It's like jumping out the window of a 50-story building in a sci-fi movie. But you're like, man, the UFO is going to grab me. I know it, you know?
Yeah. Or you just jump because, you know, maybe the building is on fire. You have no choice.
Got
you don't
no
really
other
think
choice.
Anything's going to catch you, but where else are you going to go? You got to jump, you know? And that's what I did. And so I was very much of a loner and I wanted to do everything myself. I was being the tough chick again. I asked somebody, was there a book that can teach me how to do these steps? And they're like, they're so sweet. Well, you know, there is a book. And they, showed me the book and they said, we really recommend that you get someone to help you and guide you. And then, so they kind of walked me through the process and my friend had been, she had not said anything about like sponsoring me or teaching me the steps. But when I asked her to show me how to do these things, you know, she said, I will. She says, if you're willing to do anything it takes to get sober, I'm going to teach you how to work these steps. And that's all she did. She didn't make up stuff. She didn't put any rules. She didn't, you know, she didn't force me to go to 90 and 90. She didn't force me to stop dating. Not that I was dating. But her job, as she saw it, was to teach me the steps as they were taught to her. And she was a big butt thumper. And that's how I sponsored. I, you know, the steps to me were everything. And I went to Joe and Charlie's. There was this amazing conference on the steps that I went to my second my first or second year sober. And it was the first time I'm in a huge room full of people listening to these brilliant men talk about the steps over the course of 2 days and talking about, you know, them in great depth. And I realized, mm-hmm. I don't want to fit these steps into my life. I want to fit my life into these steps. These are the principles I'm living my life by. I now knew when I got out of bed in the morning, I could direct my life to some degree.
Very empowering, isn't it?
It was incredibly empowering. Right. And I also had a resurgence of depression. I developed an eating disorder. I had done a lot of physical damage. So I was in a lot of,
sober.
Yeah. So I had a lot to deal with in early sobriety. My first 5 years were really, really challenging, but I went to meetings daily. Like I moved back to Austin. I left Vegas after a couple of years, moved back to Austin, and all I did was work and run. I became a runner and go to meetings, and I went to conferences all around the country, and I did speaker meetings, and I sponsored other women. I wasn't happy. I wasn't enjoying my life, but I had a purpose, and this is someone who wanted to kill herself, who for most of her life didn't really feel like she was worth anything. So the happiness came later. I had a lot of damage, mental and physical, to undo and to fix, and that took time. But I had a foundation. I knew I could do it because I'd been given this foundation and these coping skills. And little by little, more was revealed to me. You know, if you're living that life, if every day you're trying to be your best self, and you have guidelines, simple guidelines to do that, then more opportunities are going to you're going to see them when they come. And I started writing. You know, I worked in real estate for a while, but eventually I came to love myself so much, I started reaching for better opportunities and putting myself out there. I don't actually work as a sex therapist per se. I work in the field of sex therapy in a very niche modality, but it's something that not very many people do. I love it so much. My entire life's history and experience apply to this work. So I get even my years as an active addict, I work with a lot of clients who have trauma in their past and who don't really have great coping skills. And so, to be able to use what happened to me in those really dark years for someone else's good, it's incredibly rewarding.
It's incredibly rewarding. That's what we learned in recovery, that just like you're saying, all our darkness that we have, shame and guilt, we don't know how to process it. That is the story we tell to other people that makes us uniquely qualified to help them. And then it becomes our greatest tool, our greatest asset to help save the lives, or at least try, of others. And I love the message that you had in there that, you know, it's very important to understand that it doesn't always go hunky-dory the second we stop drinking and drugging, and there's a lot of other manifestations of our disease, which isn't just the alcohol and the drug. It's how we feel, and it can manifest in eating disorders and depression, but you don't pick up again. You keep doing the program, and in time, life turns amazing. I hear your voice. I think the listeners at home can hear how excited and how fulfilled you sound doing what you're doing and living this life you have. And like you said, you were suicidal once. So these magical transformations happen. So I'm stoked that you took the time and called us and did this interview. And, you know, you got vulnerable, like we're talking about. You shared intimate details that at some time we probably thought we would never share stuff like this. And it helps me, and I know it helps people at home. So, Kristen Casey, thank you so much for your time and phoning in. And for everybody listening at home, I hope this is another great example of no matter how bad it gets, no matter how dark it feels, there is an answer. You're not too sick. You're worth it. There's always somebody that had it worse than you that made the way out to not just a sober life, not just a recovery life, but an amazing, fulfilled, happy, joyous, and free new life. So, Kristen Casey, this is Wes Geer, and I'm your host on Rock to Recovery Radio, KX 93.5 FM, and we are out of here.